I'd like to welcome Karen Gross. She is president of Southern Vermont College. She's former senior policy advisor to the U.S. Department of Education in Washington, D.C. And we're here to talk about higher education, its costs, its benefits. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Nice to be with you.
So when I was in college, even elite schools, Ivy League schools, private schools, were full of middle-class people and scholarship students. Now we're living in a time of much greater inequality. There's greater stratification, I think, in colleges as well. What does it look like? What kind of changes have we seen in the choices college students have and are making over the past 25 years?
I think you're making a very good point that students who are attending college, and that includes, very importantly, community colleges, are increasing in terms of their diversity. But the problem is that the issue isn't just entering college, it's succeeding in college. And that's where our system is failing us, because many students enter into college, incur debt, and then don't end up with a diploma. That situation, debt without diploma, is not good.
The debt is also so much higher than it used to be for multiple reasons, including the fact that the price of college has gone up. And I don't know if this is true with community colleges, but with private colleges, it's gone up considerably faster than the rate of inflation. What's going on?
I wish there were a simple answer to why the cost of college is going up higher than the rate of inflation. Let me see if I can give you a few reasons. The first is that many colleges are giving more financial aid. That's because the federal aid that's available is covering a smaller and smaller portion of the total cost. The net consequence of all of that is that prices rise. In addition, colleges, like every other, quote, business, have increased technology needs, rising healthcare costs for their faculty and staff, and so that increases costs. Then there's added government paperwork and regulation that requires time and personnel, which increases cost. And you can add to that that there's been an increase in students who want to live on campuses, including at community colleges in some states, and that causes added cost. And interestingly for me, the growth of women's athletics is also a cost, because under Title IX, importantly, you need to offer both male and female teams. And under law, you can't just favor some versus others. So I'd say if you put all that together, what you're seeing is less public funding for higher education, and a growing privatization, even in the public sector, of where money has to come from. And that all means tuition's going up.
What do you mean by growing privatization even in the public sector?
So the amount of money that states give to public colleges has been decreasing over time. Many of our public colleges historically got a lot of their revenue from the government as opposed to from tuition. But increasingly, states, particularly in a tough economy, have cut back on the amount of money that they give to their college system. So, for example, in New Hampshire and in Vermont, these are among the lowest state funded institutions in the country. And what that means is that under 10 or 12% of their budget comes from the state. So it has to come from somewhere. And that means that in some ways, these, quote, public institutions, particularly land grants, look more like private institutions.
Student debt, as you talked about, I mean, there's the problem of debt without diploma. Even for those who do have diplomas, the debt for some students, some graduates, is absolutely crippling. It also seems to be much more rigid than other kinds of debt and more expensive. What's going on?
All right. Well, let me see if I can start by saying that not all debt is bad debt. There's actually some good debt, some good student debt. The problem is that students don't always borrow in a way that's in their best interest. The second problem is that when students borrow, other than from the government, the amount of protections after you graduate are lower. And if you borrow from the federal government, a number of students do not partake of the benefits that the federal government offers to help you reduce or spread out your payments. So we have a disconnect. We talk about the large debt on the front end, but we don't talk about the back end options, which allow income-sensitive repayment, income-based repayment, deferral, forgiveness, forbearance. And so those are issues that actually would ameliorate the problem. But you raise a very good issue in terms of how the law treats student debt, particularly in bankruptcy. So lots of student debt is non-dischargeable. You can't use bankruptcy to get rid of it. That's both government debt as well as private debt, whereas many other debts, you can go into bankruptcy and get a, what I call a fiscal fresh start. That does not work in the context of student loans. And the other amazing omission, and one actually that Senator Warren has introduced a bill on, is that student debt cannot be refinanced. So as interest rates shift, you can refinance your car loan, you can refinance your home mortgage, you can switch credit cards to ones that offer a better interest rate, but you can't refinance your student loans. That's a problem. And
indeed,
federal student loans should be able to be refinanced.
There are so many stories that come out of this. For example, one that I read recently was a student who had been paying absolutely on time, flawlessly, and then this not a student, but graduate's parents died, and the lender called the loan saying, well, we're afraid that you can't pay this in the future. And I mean, these are rules that are draconian. I mean, even mortgages don't have rules like that that I've ever seen.
I'm not sure about the particular provision that you're providing. My guess is that what you're talking about in that instance is, in fact, a loan that the parents guaranteed, or a parent plus loan that the parents actually took out. I'm not justifying it, but I am saying that they didn't probably randomly do something without the parents, who are now deceased, incurring some sort of obligation, whether primary or secondary. But you're right. We haven't thought as well as we should have about how important it is for students to get an education, but how critical it is that they be able to manage their debt when they emerge through payments that don't overburden them, that enable them to start a rich and productive life in their community, and access both employment, but also a home and start a family and the like. We need to do that. And we're failing if we're not.
So let's talk about that. We're talking to Karen Gross, president of Southern Vermont College. I mean, education in theory is preparing students to become part of our greater society. But our greater society is in trouble right now. There are fewer good jobs than ever. The corporate world is not a very friendly place. And even academia has become a pretty rough place for a lot of people. I mean, there are fewer tenured professors. There's more adjunct professors. Adjunct professors can barely make a living. From a student's perspective, who are trying to become part of a society that is fragmenting and that is plagued by inequality and insecurity, what does that look like?
Well, that's a pretty harsh depiction of the world in which we live. here's what I would say to you. I think it's fair to say that education remains the primary vehicle to obtain equality, success, and income in American society. The data are clear. If you have a college degree, you are more employable, including in times of unemployment, and you are more likely to vote, you are more likely to engage in your community, you're more likely to be healthier, and over your lifetime, your earnings will increase substantially compared to those without a degree. And in a sense, Jefferson had it right. A democracy depends on an educated populace. So for me, a degree is an appreciating asset. That's true even in a down economy. But having said that, if that opportunity isn't available to all students, regardless of their socioeconomic class, then what we're doing is we're educating the elite and the rich, and we're not educating those who are in the lower income quartiles. That scares me, that's bothersome, and that's something that we have got to remedy. If we don't, the income inequality gap will keep growing. And it's revealed, I might add, by the success in college mirroring socioeconomic status and parental education. So the more education and the more money your parents have, the more likely you are not only to go to college, but to succeed in college.
Which makes it that much harder for people whose parents didn't go to college or for people whose parents are struggling.
Yes. And there's one piece of data that I always cite, which is that if you have a combined SAT score between 800 and 1,000, that's the old system, math and English, and you're in the highest income quartile. And by the way, an 800 to 1,000 combined is not the kind of score that gets you into Ivy League institutions. That's the kind of score that state colleges look at, or community colleges, or less selective private colleges. If you're in the highest income quartile and that's your SAT score, your likelihood of graduating from a four-year college is 51%. Now, that's not that bad. That's not great, but it's not that bad. That's consistent with the national college graduation rate, which is somewhere in the 50s. But if you are in the lowest socioeconomic quartile and you have that same range in SAT score, 800 to 1,000, your likelihood of graduating from a four-year college is 8. I want to repeat it, 8%.
8%.
Now think about that. 8% of the students with the same SAT score, but coming from a lower socioeconomic quartile, are disproportionately unlikely to graduate from college. That's an issue we should be paying attention to.
Why is that?
I wish there were a simple answer to that also. I think there are a number of factors that contribute to that. One is that for many vulnerable students, they don't actually select colleges where they can succeed. There's sort of kinks in the educational pipeline, so that they may not be landing at institutions that will enable them to succeed. There's a misalignment between high schools and colleges, and the data show that lower-income students generally attend lesser-quality high schools. You might add lesser-quality educational opportunities all along the pipeline. And that affects their ability to succeed in college. Then you have the need to help support their family and family strain and lots of other psychodynamic issues that impact college success. So there's no single explanation for it, but this is something we have to address. Otherwise, we will not change the data that are showing that other nations are graduating more college students than we are. America has fallen as a nation from being near to the top of the list among OECD nations for the percentage of the population with a college degree. And now I think we rank, depending on how you calculate it, somewhere around 12th. That's not good.
Now, what is the role of early education, elementary and preschool and public education, when you think about what's going on at the college level? Is public education adequately preparing kids for college?
So, for me, this is all a problem involving the educational pipeline that actually starts at infancy, one could say even prenatally, and goes all the way through adulthood. And we have problems all along that educational continuum. So the literature show that at the very beginning, before age 3, low-income kids have heard 30 million fewer words than higher-income kids. That differential is even evident at 18 months. So if we don't start with quality infant and early childhood education, kids who grow up with parents who are lower income and without a college degree will be perpetually behind the eight ball. We have to do better. We have to put money and energy and creativity and will power into early childhood education. Now, that's not all we need to do. We need to make sure that at each sort of juncture in that pipeline, there's a good transition or you lose people. We just did a very interesting thing that your listeners may find useful. We took three leaders, one of an elementary school, one of a high school, and one of a college, three women leaders, and we all changed places for the day. And what was fascinating is that the high school head went and led the elementary school. The elementary school person came and led this college, Southern Vermont College, and I went and led the high school. And all three of us learned about ways that the educational pipeline could be improved for the benefit of all students from kindergarten through college graduation. And if you build that kind of respect among leaders so that each one doesn't blame the other for the shortcomings of the students they get, but instead work together, we stand a chance of improving that educational pipeline.
What did you learn?
First of all, I learned that college professors could learn a lot from the way elementary teachers are teaching their students with technology, because these are the students that colleges will be getting in a dozen years. And they should know that the way college professors should know that the way they're now teaching students is not the way students of the future will learn. So actually, elementary school teachers have a lot to teach college professors. Then I learned that there's a fear factor when high school seniors think about colleges. And I don't know why we haven't had more colleges talking to students, not to get them to go to their institution, but about what they can expect when they go to college. Why isn't, for example, our athletic director going into high schools and talking about what it's like to be a collegiate D3 athlete? So we're missing opportunities to create better pipelines. And finally, what I learned is that we're all actually confronting, regardless of the age of the students that we're overseeing, we're all encountering the same issues, which is that we don't have enough money to do everything, and we need to prioritize and think about how we can best innovate to help the students, not just of today, but of tomorrow.
Here in Santa Fe, we have a very good community college, and I think that it's role has shifted and grown over the years. What do you see the role of community colleges versus four-year liberal arts colleges?
I agree with you. I think the role of community colleges has truly changed over the last 25 years, both in terms of the students who attend community colleges, as well as the quality of the programs that are being offered. In many ways, community colleges have been a remarkable place for many students to start their education in an affordable way and in an environment where they're living closer to home and are comfortable. I think the challenge has been, how can students who have completed community college, and unfortunately, the degree success rate at some community colleges is not good enough, but for students who do complete community college, how can we get them to transfer to four-year colleges? And how can four-year colleges make those transfer students from community colleges more welcome? That is the challenge. And that is something that I think if we give some thought to, we can enable more and more community college graduates, particularly for those willing to travel, to think about pursuing a four-year degree after they've completed their 2 years at the community college. In fact, we've had a number of transfer students from California and other parts of the United States who do very well transferring from community colleges to our mountainside here in Vermont. And so I think it's important to realize the role of community colleges and the way they can play a significant role in helping students progress through education, not just through community college, but even through a four-year college. That's the role of community colleges in the future. They also are very good places for career development and for workforce development programs. And increasingly, the partnerships between community colleges and some of our business and corporate neighbors has been very productive in growing the workforce. So I think four-year colleges can learn a lot, actually, from two-year colleges.
Now, you were an advisor to the U.S. Department of Education. What were you doing there? What did you recommend? And what would you recommend if you could wave a magic wand to make things better in the educational system in this country?
We could talk about that for about a week. But let me first tell you what I did, and then let me give you a couple of suggestions that I think might improve the educational system. So when I was in Washington, I spent a lot of time working with veterans and military-connected families and military spouses and military children. As we draw down from Iraq and Afghanistan, there are many returning service men and women, and how they can transition from military life to civilian life is a very difficult issue, and we want to make sure that that transition is an effective one, and that those who have emerged from the military are able to re-enter the civilian workforce. And so something called the VOW Act, Veterans Opportunity to Work Act, came into existence, and there was an interagency task force to work on improving the transition assistance program to help veterans and their families transition more effectively. So I spent a lot of time on military bases with military families, with military-connected children, and with veterans, thinking about how they can succeed in higher education. And so that effort led, for example, to our campus now creating a veteran scholar cohort here so that more and more veterans can both progress to and succeed in higher education. I also worked on vulnerable student success when I was there, sharing strategies that would help our more vulnerable students get to and through college. And I spent a lot of time thinking about issues of resiliency and grit and the sort of non-traditional qualities that may be indicators of student success. That's what I did when I was in Washington. In terms of if I had a magic wand, what would I do? I probably would suggest three things. I could suggest 23, but I would suggest three. I think we have to rethink federal student aid. And we have to rethink whether there are ways that we can use that aid more effectively to help more people who need the money. And I think we have to not just think about that federal student aid in terms of its benefit to college students, but its benefit along the educational pipeline. So, by way of example, why wouldn't we encourage college students to mentor and tutor high school students in trouble? And if they did that for a certain number of hours, we reduce the interest rate of their federal student loan. So we can be creative. We need to be creative. We need to be bold in terms of how we think about federal student aid. The second change I'd make is I'd think differently about college admissions. At the present moment, college admissions is done by students submitting an application and going through a whole process, completing a FAFSA form in terms of financial aid. It's a really cumbersome and complicated process, and many vulnerable students don't even get a chance to visit colleges outside their geographic locale. I think we should consider altering the admissions paradigm, inverting it, so that high schools have a much greater say at who gets to go to college. And in fact, we have a program here with an inverted admissions paradigm that's worked hugely successfully because the high schools who pick students who come to us know these students. They've worked with them for years. And they can predict better than we can, based on SAT scores and grades, which students have fire in their belly. So the first suggestion I would have is to change federal student aid. The second is to change the admissions paradigm. And the third thing I would do is encourage innovation. We can't spend any more time rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. We've got to be bold, and we have to try new things. Technology can benefit in many ways if we think about it and study it and look at the empirical results. There are lots of other ways that we can innovate, but in the absence of innovation, the education escalator is not going up, it's going down. So it's time to innovate, even if that means taking risks, and even if it means that not everything would work.
It's funny because when you say that, I think about my education at St. John's, where I got my master's degree, which is the most old-fashioned education possible. You read books and quote-unquote great books, classics at that. You go to seminar and you talk about them. You talk about them some more over the dining table. There's no high-tech of any kind. There wasn't even a gym for a long time. And students who come from that college succeed tremendously everywhere they go. And it does make me question, I mean, there is this kind of belief in technology almost as a kind of saving thing. And I don't know if that's true.
Okay, so let's start with this. Not every student would succeed at St. John's. St. John's is for a particular kind of student who has a particular learning style and a particular training that enables them to partake of the benefits of that amazing institution. But not all students find their way through the great books. Some students find their way on a court and a field, and they work their way into coming to appreciate higher education. And for many students, college needs to be a pathway, an overt and clear pathway, without diminishing the liberal arts core, to a career, whether that's in healthcare or in criminal justice or in psychology. Now, as to the role of technology in all of this, there are certainly institutions now that are totally online. And for some students, that may work. But I actually am more of the school of thought that there is still a remarkable value, particularly for vulnerable students, to in-person, on the ground, education. And there's actually a wonderful book by a guy named Jose Antonio Bowen, who happens to be the new president of Goucher College, in which he talks about, quote, teaching naked, how moving technology out of your classroom improves student learning. So I don't think he's suggesting that there's no technology, but we should use technology wisely. So he talks about the three R's. For education to succeed, you need relationships, resilience, and reflection. You can do some of that online, for sure. But you've got to do it right, and you have to do it well. And not all of the people doing online learning are doing it as effectively as they can. So there are some things you would clearly benefit from online learning, or from athletics, or from community-based activities or other kinesthetic activities with engaged problem-solving learning. So I guess what I would say to you is technology has a role, but it's not a panacea.
Karen Gross is president of Southern Vermont College. She's former senior policy advisor to the U.S. Department of Education. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been very nice to be with you, and I appreciate your questions.